Support for the Morning Show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information available at carthage.edu/grad. Support also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, online at andreasgifts.com. And we welcome you to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Many times we talk about a special museum exhibit as it is about to open with the trumpet fanfares that typically accompany an important opening, but it's probably just as important that we talk about an important exhibit just as it is about to close. And that's the case with this interview, because something really fascinating and interesting that is currently at the museum in Milwaukee, the Milwaukee Public Museum, is about to close in early July, an exhibit called Global Kitchen, Food, Nature, Culture. It is an exhibit designed to help all of us, young and old alike, appreciate our food and maybe understand better where it comes from, and the amazing array of diets that exist all around the world, and the way in which food is such an essential part of our lives and a part of whatever culture in which we live. And the community curator for this exhibit is Martha Davis Kipchak, who knows a lot about food, cares a lot about these various issues. In fact, she is the founder of the Milwaukee Food Council and is a food entrepreneur herself, with something she created called Mighty Fine Food. And she is going to be joining us via the telephone to talk about this exhibit at the Milwaukee Public Museum, which you need to visit before it closes. Martha Davis Kipchak, we welcome you to the Morning Show.
Thank you so much, Greg. It's an honor and privilege to be here. Thank you.
Say a quick word, if you would, about your own interest in food, even ahead of being appointed to be this community curator for this particular exhibit. All your life, have you been someone who was interested in food and, in a sense, where it comes from?
Well, part of that is true. Yes, sir. All my life I have been interested in food. I was raised in the South in Deep East Texas, in Tyler, Texas, in a very food-oriented family which celebrated the kitchen and the dining table. So I love that part. But to tell you the truth, it wasn't till I moved to Wisconsin as a fully grown adult that I pivoted and really began to understand more where food came from. The state of Wisconsin is so deeply connected in a really short chain to agriculture. Almost everyone who I met moving into Milwaukee had some kind of experience with food coming up from the ground, whether it's dairy farming and their aunt, their uncle, their cousin, or their grandparents, or they grew up on it, or they had big gardens, or there was just a really beautiful connection. Hmm. And that began my deep interest in more where food came from before the whole local food movement exploded. And now I think the whole country is really interested in food that tastes good and where it comes from and what our foodway traditions are. Sometimes why we eat what we do. It's a fascinating, endlessly fascinating topic to me, because it really covers, food does, all aspects of society, from health, education, culture, history, the environment, sustainability, science. There are just so many impacts of it, social and physical.
Before we talk about the exhibit, just say a quick word about the purpose of the Milwaukee Food Council, which, from the looks of it, celebrates its 10th anniversary this year.
Yes, sir. That's exactly right. There's been a movement all across North America to have food councils, meaning a diverse group of stakeholders who come together and intentionally look at our food system, meaning from seed to growing or raising or catching to distribution to transportation to where we get our food to consumption, and then the full piece of the cycle is waste. We have a tremendous amount of food waste in our country, and that's mentioned briefly in the exhibit too. So it's a fascinating topic, and we don't really have an intentional group that looks overall at the system of food. We definitely have pieces of that. So this is a concerned group of citizens that has health, government, educators, concerned citizens, agriculture, faith communities, all coming together to examine and help make our food system more just and sustainable.
Wonderful. So say a word about this exhibit that we've heard so much about at the Milwaukee Public Museum called Global Kitchen. And did you have a hand in actually constructing this exhibit?
No, I didn't, and neither did any of us at the Milwaukee Public Museum. This exhibit was created initially by the American Museum of Natural History in New York City and has been traveling the country for the past 3 or 4 years. So it's been to many cities. I got to see it a couple of years ago in Washington, D.C. at the National Geographic Museum as we were anticipating it coming to Milwaukee. It's very well done. It's a snapshot, again, because food is really complicated, and to fully address the history of food would be the history of man, would be a challenge. But I think they did an excellent job of giving those of us who look at the exhibit just an idea of trade and transportation, the impact on the environment, on how food is grown, the role of food in one's daily life, and the societal impact. There's one big diorama of an Aztec village, and you even get noises and a whole view of, you know, that would be the center of commerce, of how people came into the village and got their food and traded and fed each other. I mean, we all have to eat in order to sustain ourselves, so the impact is really significant.
I know that there have been various areas of emphasis as the exhibit has been on display since March. And right now, appropriately enough, in the closing couple of weeks, the focus is on dairy and maybe more specifically on why Wisconsin is known as America's Dairyland. What do we learn about this from the exhibit?
Well, I will say that there is a demonstration kitchen embedded in the exhibit, and so that would be one place to kind of call out and make the exhibit more personal to our own local environment, such as Wisconsin dairy, and there will be some demonstrations about butter, or there's also a calling out about fermentation, and the making of cheese is all part of the big idea around cultures and fermentation. So I think that that would be the way that it would highlight Wisconsin dairy. There are also places within the exhibit that highlights what's going on in the greater Milwaukee area on the ground on a grassroots effort, such as the organization Teens Grow Greens, which is teaching young people how to grow food, not just grow food, but then they actually market their food so that there are all sorts of other skills beyond agriculture that are learned about how to negotiate business.
I know that the...
So go ahead.
I know that the exhibit also includes... some artifacts. Can you just tell us about one or two of the most interesting artifacts that are part of this exhibit?
Well, let me think. There is one whole wall around tools, which is fascinating to see all the different tools that have been used over history, at least a glimpse of history of the preparation and eating of food. There is one piece that calls out what a ancient primitive man would have eaten in his diet daily. A more current artifact would be just a snapshot of what Michael Phelps might consume in a single day when he is training as a swimmer.
Wow.
Which is fascinating. And there are bigger whole rooms that are set up, like, for instance, Jane Austen's dining room and what she may have eaten and the environment in which she ate it, and actually showcased ice cream, which is pretty fascinating. Yes, that. There are things like that.
Wow.
Is that what you mean by artifact?
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And you, it sounds from what you are describing like this is an exhibit that really is designed for people of all ages, that just about anybody can come to this exhibit and learn a lot and be also, I guess, entertained, if that's the word. I mean, this is going to be interesting for young and old alike.
Well, food is one of those just fascinating things that really crosses all lines. I mean, it can be health, but it can be recreation. I mean, that's what we do when we celebrate with each other for any occasion whatsoever, whether we're going to the ballpark, I mean, we're going to tailgate, or it's a birthday, or if it's a funeral, or what, we eat together when we gather. And so the exhibit tries to call out snapshots of those experiences.
We want to remind people that this exhibit is about to close on the 9th of July. Martha Davis Kipchak is the community curator for it, and if people are interested in tickets, you can call 414-278-2728 to reserve a ticket for the Milwaukee Public Museum and to be sure that you can take in this exhibit called Global Kitchen. Martha Davis Kipchak.
Can I interject one more thing, Greg? When you the Global Kitchen is included in the museum experience, so there's no upcharge for the exhibit. You can buy a family four-pack on a weekend for $55 through July 9th, and that includes everything you need. The Milwaukee Public Museum is a fantastic resource and asset for our community.
Very good. I quite agree. Martha Davis Kipchak, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Greg. Take care. Bye-bye.
It's 8:23, and you're listening to the Thursday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. We're digging into the archives now for an interview which goes way, way back, all the way back to the fall of 1998, not long after I began handling the morning show on sort of a full-time basis. This is one of the first author interviews that I actually ever did, and it was with a husband and wife, Naomi Duguid and Jeffrey Alford, the co-authors of a really interesting book called Seductions of Rice, a cookbook. But this book is so much more than a cookbook. The book is also a book that celebrates the wonders of rice, the importance of it all around the world in all kinds of different cultures, the amazing array of varieties of rice, and all of the amazing things that one can do with rice. This was the second book by these two. They had previously written a book called Flatbreads and Flavors, and they have written many other books besides. They are world travelers, and it was actually on a trip to Tibet that they each took, that they first crossed paths and fell in love and ultimately forged a personal and professional partnership. This book called Seduction of Rice is published by Artisan. Things I loved in the preface of the book was when you said that rice is the great facilitator, unrivaled.
Tell us how you think of rice as a facilitator. That's a beautiful choice of words.
Well, we think of it in cooking terms. And basically, when you go in to prepare dinner at night, and we're like, I think a lot of people, you know, we only think of it at the last moment. And so we go into the kitchen and we put on a pot of rice to cook. And then we think about what we're going to have for dinner, and it's going to be something that's going to be with rice. And it's sort of unrivaled, really. Potatoes are the thing that come most to mind, but rice accommodates so many different dishes, and it's actually so at the heart of so many different cuisines. So you know, we can have a Thai dish and a Chinese dish and a, you know, Indian dish, and it's all there working around the rice. In North America, we eat not so much rice, but each year that's increasing as people get more exposed to other types of cuisines. And I think we'll just see that more and more over time because it's such a smart, easy food to make. You know, you've got almost half your meal made, and you haven't even had to think about it.
I am no world traveler nor an expert, but I have one story about rice as a facilitator, which is that when I was on choir tour in the Dominican Republic, our host family served us a very, very thick, heavy, spicy, wonderful chili, but that would have just about blown off my head, I think.
Yeah.
Had it not been served in a bowl over rice, and that's how they almost always served this wonderful chili in this, at least in this household in the Dominican Republic. That's really the first time I'd ever had rice as that sort of a thing that kind of absorbed a really powerful flavor and made it more beautiful in a sense.
Yeah, and kind of mellowed it out and helped it link to other things. I mean, that's a wonderful story, and it's a real example of what rice can do, you know, at the table. And also, of course, if you eat your rice and then have other things, then someone who doesn't like one thing can eat the other things. And you always know that rice is there as the backbone of the meal.
You mentioned that rice is the staple food of more than half the world's population, which probably makes it then the most predominant food on the globe.
It is in terms of on people's tables, yeah.
How has it achieved that? What is it about rice? Because I don't think it's particularly easy to grow. I mean, in the way that, I mean, my impression is that potatoes, for instance, are extremely easy to grow. But rice requires care and quite a lot of moisture and so on.
Oh, it absolutely does. I think that sort of the demographics of the rice is just simply because in those two very big countries, China and India, you have a lot of rice eaters. So those numbers, you know, go way up. It is. It's extremely difficult to grow, it's labor intensive to grow.
Hmm.
You find, I think the United States is now the world's largest or the second largest exporter of rice, which is a little bit deceptive. You know, it's grown so much in California, but even
Texas.
But those numbers, even though it's the largest exporter, it's still just a fraction of what is being grown in Asia.
You tell us.
So many people eat it because where they live, you can get a lot of rice per acre. It's quite a generous crop if you've got enough water. And in a lot of places where rice is the staple, there's either a monsoon rain that people can use to irrigate the land, or they have a steady supply of water. For example, in Bali, there's water coming off the volcano all the time. And then people have developed, you know, have rice channels and irrigation. And then on an acre of land, they can raise quite a lot of food.
Hmm.
So in that way, it has its generous side, too, as long as you're organized and put the labor in.
You say that rice is a grain, and what we're eating is the fruit of that grass plant. What does rice, generally speaking, look like out in the field? What does the plant look like, and the stuff that we end up eating? What does that look like?
It looks quite like wheat. You know, it's green, lush green, as it's growing, and then as it's coming towards harvest, it goes golden yellow, and then the pot, the seeds are there at the top, like if you have a piece of grass in your yard that you don't cut, and pretty soon it gets that feathery bit at the top.
The head gets kind of heavy and tips over a little, and it's a beautiful golden color. And the seeds are inside sort of those a dry sort of husky thing, and when you take that when you take them out of the husk, and they often fall out of the husk, then inside is what would be brown rice. You could cook that from inside the husk. You could, you know, pound the husk on some hard surface so that the grains pop out of the husk, and then inside would be a brown rice. And then to get from there to white rice, it needs to be milled in a mill, or you can do it in a mortar and pestle to get the bran off. But that, it's really, you're really eating something directly from the plant.
Which is, I suppose, part of its mystique, or part of what makes it a wonderful sort of food, knowing that it has not undergone a huge amount of human technological processing.
That's right, and it also keeps well, because you know, a milled white rice you can store, and if it's dry and, you know, airtight in a bag, it'll keep well.
We classify rice as long grain or medium grain or short grain. What exactly do those terms mean? Have I asked something complicated there?
People will talk loosely, you know, we'll say, oh, that short grain rice, or oh, that long grain rice, and then those terms are also used really kind of technically, you know. So, you know, long grain is, it's the proportion of the length to the width, basically, is what makes something long grain or medium grain or short grain.
Is that an important, significant distinction for the sake of choosing rice and cooking rice and so on, or not particularly?
Not particularly, no. It's more kind of how the rice behaves, what kind of starches it has in it. And, you know, most people cook the rice they grew up with. You know, we cook only sort of two or three rices. In a steady way. So they just have their rice habit and they know how to cook it. They're not saying, oh gosh, what's this rice? Oh, this is what I have to do. Do you see what I mean?
Yes.
Every rice has, some rice is cooked to a drier texture, like a basmati, and some rice is cooked to a sort of softer, more clinging texture, like a Thai jasmine rice or a Japanese rice. And then some rices are really sticky and clingy, like a Thai sticky rice. I don't know if you've ever had it with it's often used in sweets, and it clumps up, and you actually eat it in your hands like a cracker. It's fabulous rice.
And different rices can have very different smells, and it becomes very important to people who are eating that rice every day to expect that smell. And then if you switch to a different rice, like a parboiled rice has a distinctive smell that, you know, I don't like. And I think for most people, in our house, we eat primarily a jasmine rice. And we really want that smell. Every time we cook rice, that's the smell that goes into the kitchen, just like when bread is baking. And you get very attached to that smell. And then a different rice will have a different smell, and it won't be appetizing.
It won't be either appetizing at all, or it won't be as appetizing.
Interesting. You mentioned the fact that once upon a time, you would walk down the aisle of a typical American supermarket, and you'd have essentially one kind of rice available to you, and not particularly good rice. You're saying that has begun to change, that now you go into a supermarket, and there will be some choices available to you, and some of that rice will probably be pretty good rice.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You're going to find, you'll find some Italian rices, either grown in Italy or Italian style, grown in California. You'll find jasmine rices from Thailand, and maybe also jasmine style rices grown in Texas. You'll find, you'll also have, so there's a bunch of imported rices, and there's also a diversity of kinds of rice being grown in the States. And of course, Japanese style rices grown in California.
But curiously, in a supermarket these days, you'll find rice in several different places. Because some of it's classified under, you know, health food or specialty food, but even though it's just all just rice.
You say that poor quality rice is featureless and tasteless. I'm especially curious about we all know what tasteless food is, but I'm curious what exactly you mean when you say that not so good rice is featureless. Do you mean that it's very plain looking?
No, I guess more. It has no character or personality. You know, if you can, I guess the best analogy is bread. You know, when you eat a bread that you like, and It isn't necessarily, you know, brown or rye or anything sort of strong. It's mild, but it still has character to you.
Yes.
You know, it's identifiable. You can think, oh, yes, that bread. And then you can eat a bread that's very factory produced and perhaps not, you know, has no particular anything. And it's not really about tastelessness. It's about lack of personality. It's almost like even if it did once have it, it had the personality beaten out of it, you know. And I think that's really, that's some of what we're talking about. But, you know, taste in rice, like taste in bread, is really personal. And so it really, you know, what I might love, you might really dislike. You might think, oh, I don't like that clinging rice. I like a drier basmati. Or, you know, we all have our preferences, and they're all part of the world of rice eating.
Right. You as people in love with rice who eat it all the time, are there kinds of rice that you really do not like at all and really do not want to eat? I guess I'm asking, are there certain kinds of rices that are, for whatever reason, maybe all but inedible? Or are they all wonderful food and just your preferences are just, you know, according to personal taste?
I think the second thing, there, you know, what's, for example, brown rice. You know, if you go to Japan, and most people wouldn't think of eating brown rice, but brown rice, if you grew up with it or if you came to it because you did macrobiotics or for whatever reason, has a wonderful, you know, nutty flavor. It takes a little more chewing, and, you know, those are kinds of things that, you know, brown rice might fill one person with horror and another person might think that it was, you know. So it's really that. Jeff, do you feel the same way, sir?
Oh, I think, as I mentioned before, some parboiled rices I would have a hard time eating. Because there's just a taste that I don't like.
but for other people, they're really the taste of home, and they're wonderful.
Hmm. Interesting.
Know? Yeah.
I wondered if it was something like, for instance, berries. I mean, there are a lot of berries that everybody loves, and there are some berries that you know, are more of an acquired taste, and there are some berries that are downright poisonous, or that really should not be eaten by human beings for whatever reason. It
we
sounds
don't
like
know of any rices in that inedible category.
Okay.
No.
So it really is, you know, what you grew up with, and
it's probably true that for every rice, there is someone who loves that rice.
We're speaking with Jeffrey Alford and Naomi Duguid. They are the authors of Seductions of Rice, a big, beautiful, wonderful coffee table book that celebrates rice with a whole host of marvelous recipes, but also, in some ways, even more helpful to those of us that don't know very much about rice, all kinds of wonderful, helpful information about what rice is and all the different ways there are to prepare it. I should add, I almost kind of placed a bet with myself that we would see the words rice-a-roni on the pages of this book, and sure enough, there they are, mentioned very briefly in the preface. But I imagine rice-a-roni is not on your household menu very often.
No, in fact, I can't remember when I last saw it even. You know, in a store. That's really an interesting thing.
It's still there, but
it is, eh? Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's still there.
we tend to really we love all those simple dishes that go with rice, and that's part of why we wrote the book, because we like, you know, those easy stir fries and so on in the China chapter, or some of the sauces and chutneys and yummy relishes.
But you want to do the pudding together. You don't want someone else to do that and put it in a box for you.
Right. Exactly.
You tell us that there are several different ways to cook rice, but before it, there is the important step of washing. I liked how you discussed this, because there are different reasons to wash rice, depending on where you are or where you've acquired your rice. Explain that a little bit.
Do you cook rice at home?
Me?
Yeah, you.
My wife does, and I'll stir it once in a while. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's really interesting, because in the States, many people, the bags say don't wash this rice, bags of rice grown in the States. And that's because most rice grown in the States is enriched. And that came from apparently in the 30s when, you know, during the Depression, they felt that any way they could get more nutrition out to people at the basic level, so that all rice was enriched. But in fact, we wash our rice, as most people in Asia do, for example, because then the rice cooks more evenly and to a texture we prefer. So, and you'll find this tradition in Japan, for example. If you go to a sushi restaurant and you were working for a sushi master and you were in charge of washing the rice, that sushi master would have you wash the rice perhaps 15 times. Now, it's not like we do that at home, but that's to tell you the importance of getting it so all the loose starch is washed off it and it gets a little moistened and then it cooks really evenly. Mm.
That's right. I think you go on to say that your diet is one where those little added nutrients in the rice you buy in America, for instance, are rather inconsequential.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's really, for anybody who's sort of reading the book, most people, this is not going to be it's not going to be a relevant thing.
Hmm. The most common method of cooking rice is the absorption method, and I had never really stopped to think about that, that is actually what's happening when you cook rice in this most conventional way, that you are putting it in a pot of water and then each of those kernels of rice is absorbing some of the water around it.
Yeah, so often referred to as steaming, but it's actually not steaming. Steamed rice, or we call it steamed rice, but I think we wanted to make that distinction very clear in the book, because then there is that, which Naomi mentioned before, sticky rice, which actually literally is steamed. It's soaked overnight in water, and it absorbs that water, and then you drain what's left of the water, and then we actually use a basket, and we put the rice in a basket, and then we put it over the hot water, and it's literally steamed.
And it doesn't touch water at all. You don't have to measure quantities or anything. It just steam cooks.
Huh.
Whereas the rice, the absorption cooking, is actually in the water and taking the water in and cooking in the hot water.
Now, is there a reason to avoid the absorption method of cooking rice?
We think it's the best one.
But in your particular, your preferred method, I guess, is what I meant.
That's our preferred method.
Mm-hmm.
So that you, nothing gets washed away, right? And, you have, the rice is, and the water, you're eating it all. And the rices that we tend to eat as our daily rice are best cooked that way, with absorption method. Different rices, lend themselves better to different ways of cooking.
Mm-hmm.
The other major method being cooking rice as people cook pasta. You have a lot of water, and you simply cook the rice in that hot water until it's done, and then you drain the remainder of the water.
Mm. That's sort of the simplest way, I suppose, in a sense, but...
Cooking some rice, you can cook basmati that way and it's fine. But if you tried to cook Thai jasmine that way, it would just sort of disintegrate into kind of mush. It's not, the grain's not strong enough to handle being, bashed around in boiling water like that.
Hmm. You mentioned at one point that for a brief time you used a rice cooker. I've never actually seen a rice cooker before. What kind of a machine is that? And is it worth investigating?
Oh, well, they're sort of magic things. They vary a great deal in their how sophisticated they are. But we actually use one up in the country, and it's electric, and it looks sort of like one of those old slow cookers or crock pots. It sort of looks like. And you simply put the rice in, put the water in to the measured level, and click the button, and it's magic. It just cooks it, and when it's done, it shuts itself off.
Wow!
But it has the advantage that it keeps the rice warm quite a long time, and so for people who are eating rice, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, it's a very handy thing.
And the other thing is, if you're a forgetful person or inclined to be distracted, you wash your rice, you put it in the rice cooker. It's got an inner sort of pot, and then you put the rice in there with the water. Then you put the lid on the whole thing, and it's just a round thing. It sits on the table, doesn't take up a burner on the stove. You plug it in, turn it on, and then you can forget about it. You don't have to remember that when it comes to the boil, you need to turn it down or, any of those things. So a rice cooker is wonderful. Now, there's really sophisticated ones that you can program, to turn on at 6:30 at night or whatever, but we're not in that category. We have a really plain one, and it's done us really fine.
You mentioned that you used one quite regularly for a while, maybe a year, but then returned to cooking it in your friendly heavy pot.
Yeah.
Any particular reason why you made that switch back?
It just Yeah, I think it's sort of familiarity, and we were used to the texture of the rice in the pot and liked it. But now we have this kind of a very rough cabin in the country, and it does have electricity, but it doesn't have, we have pretty primitive cooking devices otherwise. Hmm. And so actually the rice cooker has come back into its own and is up there, and we use it all the time up in the country. So it's really, and it tastes fine to us. We're not complaining or thinking we should be using a pot or anything.
Hmm. We're speaking with Naomi Duguid and Jeffrey Alford about their book called Seductions of Rice. I should mention that there's a very helpful glossary in the book, which is quite helpful. And it brings to mind one term which I wanted to be sure to ask you about, which is wild rice. That's grown not too far from here in northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin, and I know a lot of people around this part of the country that really love to eat that kind of wild rice. But we probably shouldn't confuse that maybe with other ways that we can talk about wild rice, since that's where all of this came from originally.
Yeah, there's wild rice and there's wild rice. The wild rice in North America isn't, you know, technically, I guess, according to the botanist, it's not technically a rice in the sense that the rices we're talking about it for Chinese cuisine or Thai cuisine are rices. It's also a grass. But the interesting thing is, and those rices from Japan and China, their ancestors grew wild, and there were rices growing wild in Africa. And they're different from the North American ones. But the North American wild rice, if you think about it, its place in native culture and a native, you know, culinary tradition was very like the place of, you know, rice, if I can put it that way, in Asia. In other words, it was a staple grain. It was harvested. It took work. It was dried out and threshed and treated with respect. And so it really, in that sense, at the cultural level, I guess you could say, it's as much a rice as any rice from anywhere else.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about the growing of rice. You've already mentioned the fact that it's quite labor-intensive. It is no easy matter to grow rice, but it can happen in all kinds of different climates. Within all those different climates, is it still grown essentially the same way?
Not necessarily. Most, maybe you could help on it, but there's a distinction between elevations at which it's grown and how much water it's going to use.
Well, some rices, the rices that grow in the tropics where there's lots of rain, they still mostly, they can either depend on monsoon rain and, you know, a flooding and hot weather. Or you can grow rices in temperate climates like California or Japan or Spain or Italy. And that's, again, going to be seasonal. The rice is going to take longer to ripen. But there's also people, and this is, of course, how rice seems to have started, who still grow rice in sort of slash-and-burn agriculture, people living in the mountains in Southeast Asia, in Borneo, for example. And there, the rice seeds just get scattered on the ground. They wait for the monsoon rains to come to moisten them. And then the rice grows just with help from Mother Nature, with no irrigation. And grows, I guess, kind of like the best analogy would be the way corn was grown by native people here, with knowledge and attention, but not in any way that looks like, you know, careful fields. And perhaps more harmoniously with nature. So it grows in different ways. Some ways you can describe it are dry land cultivation, sort of on hillsides waiting for the rain to fall, as opposed to those kind of irrigated wet rice paddies that are the kind of classic, almost cliche shot of rice growing in the tropics.
Hmm. One really interesting page in the book, now this is where it's frustrating that we're on the radio instead of television, but there's one page where you have a whole array of, let's see, 9, 18, 27, 36 different kinds of rice laid out for us to see and compare side by side. And it's kind of interesting to me how, in some ways, they all look rather similar. And maybe we would even think that these are all rices. And yet they are amazing in their diversity of shape and color and from what I can tell, texture as well.
Isn't that interesting, that picture? Isn't it beautiful, too, the reds and the and and the blacks and the different shades of gold.
Let's talk a little bit about the nutritional value of rice. There are a couple of interesting points about rice that that make it, in some ways, nutritious, in some ways, something that we should maybe be a little bit careful about. Tell us a little bit about that.
I don't think we know the ones that we should be careful about, particularly.
Well, it depends on what you think about starch, because it is high in starch, correct?
Well, it's carbohydrate. It's
carbohydrate.
Yeah.
Part of that carbohydrate is starch, and we're not nutritionists. So, but we have been, spent sort of basically our adult life traveling, and we just think there's a simple fact. If you look at for one thing, obesity, and you look at areas of the world where people eat primarily rice, the very low levels of obesity. And then you go around where you know, those other areas of the world where people aren't eating rice, and there's a great deal more obesity.
And in Japan now, as people are switching from rice eating to a more westernized diet, they're starting for the first time to have problems with obesity. So it's not a matter of people being thin because they're poor. It really is a matter of somehow the way the diet works, so we think if you eat, rice-based, but, and you can have your bits of meat and lots of fresh vegetables, and that seems to us, and certainly from what the nutritionists tell us, to be a really easy and balanced way to eat. And really diverse. You're eating different things all the time.
Well, exactly. I was going to say this goes back to rice as the great facilitator, the fact that it almost encourages one to be making use of all these other things that we all need to be eating more of, vegetables primarily.
Absolutely. And it encourages you, to eat seasonal fruits and vegetables too, because, if you're going to supplement your rice that night, you're going to go shopping and see what's in season.
One thing that you mentioned that I thought was real interesting, you've said you're not nutritionist, but you've raised some interesting issues here. One of them being the difference between white rice and brown rice, and the fact that one might be a little higher in nutrition, but that one is easier to digest than another.
Yeah, we found that fascinating when we were doing our research and reading. Very, very interesting, all of that. I think if the main thing we've concluded about nutrition is that nobody really still knows. We don't really understand everything that's in everything. We can break down elements, but really what the effect of eating that real food is on us, it's a bit of a mystery.
You take us through the balance of the book through all kinds of cuisines across the world. And one of the things that I so appreciate is that it just goes to show what a typical American thinks, that there's a big chapter about Chinese rice, and then there's another big section about Japanese rice. And to me, it would never occur to me that there's any significant difference between them or between the way they are prepared. And, of course, that's just, American ignorance at play again. All of these cuisines have their own unique ways of treating rice and using it.
Oh, very much so. And that was pretty much, for us, the heart of the book was trying to sort of make encapsulate these primarily the four India, China, Japan, and Southeast Asia, and give people here in North America a way of basically cooking dinner and switching to becoming sort of rice eaters, and we thought they're sort of like four little joys of cooking. There's probably 25 recipes in each of those chapters that are real basics, and for us, it's the way we eat at home, and we look at the whole book as sort of trying to represent a way of eating, rice being at the center of that, but by no means eating tons of rice. It's just a way of thinking about meals.
One of the things that is interesting to me is the wonderful photography. You are photographers, correct?
Yeah.
And
You like it.
Yeah, you've really captured some wonderful scenes, and even just the faces of some of these people, many of them simple people, farmers and so on, but very alluring in just being up close and personal with many of these people. And we just get the sense that this is a great adventure for you traveling the planet and finding rice everywhere you go.
Absolutely.
It's been a huge adventure for us. And we I think one of the reasons we started out doing it was because when we started to have a family, it's what we wanted to do as a family. We wanted, you know, when we go to a country, we're primarily interested in being in villages and not in cities. And it for one reason is because we enjoy it more. And when the kids, our kids are now 12 and 15, and they've pretty much been going since they were born. And they're very comfortable in, you know, in villages in many parts of the world. And it when we come home, I mean, it's just been good for all of us.
For an American, typical American, picking up this book, where would you suggest they start in terms of the recipes? I guess I'm asking, is there a particular cuisine that you think is a good starting point, or does it really depend on a given person's own preferences?
I don't know, Jeff, what you'd say. That's a really good question. I think because most people are familiar with the notion maybe of a stir fry, or they've maybe eaten Thai out in restaurants recently, I'd go to the China chapter and the Thai chapter and just pick out things that catch your eye. The recipes are in the whole book are very simple. They're very home-style, easy-to-prepare recipes. But I think in those two chapters, you'd find the most familiar. And if people are sushi lovers, they're in the Japan chapter, of course, there's all of that. But for people for whom Japanese food still feels a bit foreign, probably Chinese and Thai are the easiest places to start. And, you know, you can make an easy chicken soup, or you can make a grilled beef salad, a Thai grilled beef salad, or a quick stir-fry of Chinese greens with a little pork. And, you know, it's sort of like falling off a log, if you know what I mean. It's really, it's very 1-2-3 food. And once you've made a recipe once, you can think, oh, right, that was really simple, you know. And then you can come at it again and start adding your own touches to it.
That's something else that rice seems to encourage, is a wonderful diversity of experimentation and trying things out. I think you mentioned in the chapter where you devote attention to Thai cooking, Thai cuisine, is that they especially celebrate sort of the unpredictable and really cherish that above following the rules and so on.
Well, we just are constantly amazed in Thailand at, you know, people are just, it's not that they like odd food or anything. They just eat an enormous range of food that, you know, there's just sort of a happiness around food. And, you know, oh, yeah, I'll try it. If it's there, I'll try it. And it's not something that I'm really particularly, I grew up as a very sort of picky eater and to arrive in Thailand, just an incredible diversity of food and the sort of that fun aspect.
Yes, you say it embraces improvisation and scorns rigidity.
Right.
Beautifully put. Wonderful writing and wonderful pictures and wonderful information and ideas to be found in this book called Seductions of Rice by Jeffrey Alford and Naomi Duguid, published by Artisan of New York. Jeffrey Alford, Naomi Duguid, a real pleasure to read this book and to talk with you about it and your love affair with rice on The Morning Show today. We thank you so much.
It's been great.
Very
thank
nice
you, Greg. Thank you.
Tomorrow on The Morning Show, I'm excited to speak with Jim Schatzman from Racine Vocational Ministries and with two of the clients that the agency has assisted in some very, very exciting ways. Monday on The Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation recorded with former Wisconsin Governor Martin Schreiber. His book is My Two Lanes, Learning to Coping and Surviving as an Alzheimer's Caregiver. He's coming to southeastern Wisconsin next week at the invitation of Society's Assets. Support for The Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. And don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andreas, 2401 60.